Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. On the international front, all eyes are on two locations, the Ukraine, where Russian-based insurgents and Ukrainian authorities are clashing, as well as Syria and Iraq, where the West and Iraq are struggling with ISIS, a force that came out of the Arab Spring, the revolt against the Syrian Assad regime. Well, my guest today is well acquainted with both the current conflict in the Ukraine and the aftermath of the Arab Spring. When you look at the Arab Spring, Syria has been embroiled in a horrific civil war. Egypt has returned to an authoritarian state through a military coup. Libya is almost feudal-like state of rivaling militias. The one bright spot has been the place where the Arab Spring actually began, Tunisia. Tunisia has been embarking on a constitutional process and is due to have new elections this fall. My guest today, Tom Garrett, native Oklahoman and vice president of the International Republican Institute, has been aiding that cause of nation building in Tunisia. He's also worked extensively in Ukraine, where he served as his first post with the IRI as the country director for Ukraine and later in Belarus and Moldova. From 2004 to 2009, he's been the regional director for the Middle East and North Africa, and today he's the vice president for global programs. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week, and I spoke with him while he was here. Tom Garrett, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's been a couple of years now since the Arab Spring, and yet we're still dealing with the aftermath of the Arab Spring when it relates to Syria. And the success, the initial euphoria has definitely worn off that spring where all of a sudden you saw these Arab governments toppling their totalitarian or autocratic governments. And yet the success has not been, on the whole, truly marked, with perhaps the exception of the country that let it all off, and that was Tunisia. What's going on in Tunisia? You've spent a lot of time in Tunisia lately.
Yeah, well, let me just say that the Arab Spring is a process that's still unfolding. And as you say, it's unfolding in a somewhat difficult manner. At the institute that I work in, the International Republican Institute, we do believe that still trying to support democratic transitions is the best bet. Democracy is a system, it takes time. It's hard to implement. It takes time to mature. And we've actually seen some less positive developments, I would say, out of the Arab Spring. Egypt, for instance, had a democratically elected government just last year that was removed by its military. This sends a very bad message that democracy is not capable of taking root. That's why I'm here in Tulsa to speak about Tunisia. Tunisia is, at the moment, a matter of some optimism for most people who watch the Middle East. And I think that optimism is pretty well placed. But I would just say that Tunisia's transition to democracy is by no means certain. It's still somewhat fragile, and it still needs both U.S. attention and U.S. support.
Now, give us a sense, for those not familiar with Tunisia. Tunisia, right in the middle, the top of Africa, across from France and Italy, the Ben Ali government, how long did they run the government? This was the ousted president that was ousted in the Arab Spring.
Tunisia is in a tough neighborhood. You do mention across the Mediterranean, Europe, France, but immediately next to it, it's anchored in between Libya, between Algeria. Again, a tough neighborhood for a very small country. President Ben Ali took power almost 3 decades ago, and he ruled essentially as a one-party, one-man government. It was interesting, though, most observers saw the Ben Ali government as fairly stable, as there for the long run. I think just shortly before the Arab Spring kicked off in Tunisia, U.S. embassies in the region were saying we have to learn how to work with these people and their successors because they're not going away. Well, when the protests started in Tunisia, within less than a month, President Ben Ali and his family had packed up their loot and were headed out the door. They first attempted to go to France, and I think they saw a life on the Riviera ahead for them. And instead, France rejected them because of the extent of the crimes he had committed against his own country. So now he's actually luxuriating in Saudi Arabia, which is probably not a place he was really looking forward to.
Yeah. In fact, I've heard his government referred to as a kleptocracy.
Very much so. And, you know, one of the interesting things that happened was the WikiLeaks of a few years ago. You may remember that when so many State Department cables were made public. Tunisians were shocked to read the U.S. ambassador's private cable to Washington about the Ben Ali government. People in Tunisia thought Washington, the U.S., supported Ben Ali. Instead, our ambassador wrote a very scathing piece about the kleptocracy and the destruction that the Ben Ali family was wreaking on Tunisia. And when they saw that, it was one of the first chinks in this 3 decades armor.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. Unlike the rest of the states of the Arab Spring, Tunisia has been fairly stable. Now, they've had their share of setbacks in sort of putting in democratic institutions, and especially in economic institutions, because this family controlled, I think it was something like 30% of the GDP of the country among a closely held family and a number of cronies. That's been very difficult for those companies and that part of the economy to actually, I guess, redistribute, if you will, or however you would end up doing that. But give us a sense of what's happening towards real elections, which are scheduled to happen this fall.
So, you know, I think one of the reasons you mentioned the economy and how hard it's been to spring back, I think outside companies, international investments are waiting to see what happened in these elections. Will Tunisia continue along a path to democratic consolidation? We're not sure. You know, they have had one election in Tunisia, and that was in 2011, and that was to elect a constituent assembly that would draft a new constitution. In those elections, as in elections in every country of the Arab Spring, the initial results were a big win for the Islamists. But Tunisia's Islamic parties have proven themselves somewhat different from those in the rest of the region. They actually made a very strong outreach to the secular parties. They included them in the coalition government. And so when it was time this year for the government to step aside for an interim government before the election, we saw the Islamist-controlled government of Tunisia peacefully step aside and turn over power.
That's amazing.
So these have all been wonderful examples of how things could work. But we do have this election coming, October 26. There will be numerous candidates on the ballot. There are new parties as well as some of the older parties that had struggled against Ben Ali through those three decades. The country seems somewhat divided, and it really is anyone's guess as to which direction it goes as opposed to secular parties versus Islamic-based parties. But again, we do have a somewhat brief but positive track record that the Islamic parties are looking for a unified country rather than a theocracy or a exclusionary government.
Now, how much did the Egyptian elections affect that reluctance to invest in someplace like Tunisia? Because you saw the Muslim Brotherhood really take over, and then, of course, military came in and toppled that government. How much are businesses looking at what happened in Egypt and fearful of investing in someplace like Tunisia?
Well, again, I think most companies, before they put large investments into a place, they need to know who they're dealing with and what they're dealing with. Again, Tunisia's history is a kleptocracy. It was not only the people of Tunisia that were robbed by the Ben Ali family, but foreign investors were always shaken down, never knew if their investments were safe. So a wise investor is probably taking just a very brief step, brief wait, watching to see what does happen in October. But my prediction is we get through the October and November elections. Again, whichever type of government, most likely coalition governments, I would say, are going to emerge, I think Tunisia will be poised to really see its economic situation turn around.
How much do you lay upon on the Islamist government that did win the majority of the votes in the last election, that ability to reach out to, I mean, it was kind of like our founding fathers, you know, there were no political parties at the beginning. It was about how can we make this work? Then the political parties come in, come to effect. It seems like there's been a real strong outreach to really make this work, a democracy work.
Yes, there has been a strong outreach, and our U.S. government has invested a lot of money in supporting the free trade unions of Tunisia, in trying to support the political parties, not financially, but through work such as ours at the International Republican Institute. We do training programs in which we work with all of the political parties in Tunisia, not just those that mirror us or we might like. We work with all the parties committed to democracy in Tunisia to teach them how to build coalitions, how to recruit young people and women, how to communicate with voters. You know, it's been three decades of a dictatorship where the people's will was never of interest to anyone in leadership. Now, today we are teaching candidates, men and women candidates, how to go knock on doors, ask for votes, and it's something very, very different for them. I am, again, optimistic that these elections are going to give the people of Tunisia finally a feeling that they're invested in their government.
When I look at countries like Tunisia, where you know you have vestiges of colonialism, maybe a brief moment of democracy in the immediate independence, and then a dictator takes over, these democratic institutions are beyond fragile. I mean, they're like a thin crust, a veneer, if you will.
As a matter of fact, the fact that they were just a veneer makes people distrust them now. You know, people's experience in Tunisia with political parties is with Ben Ali's party, which pretended to govern them democratically, but actually elections were a sham. There was no real competition. It was really interesting.
Did they win 90% of the vote?
Absolutely. I went into Tunisia shortly after the beginning of the Arab Spring. When we flew in, there were still machine gun emplacements at the airport, fires still downtown, and the city was under a curfew. But already there were Tunisian women activists, political party members, labor union representatives, journalists. We just found open doors everywhere we went, as people said, you know, finally we have a chance to determine our own future, and are you able to help us? Again, not financially, not directly, but with training, with ideas, with exposing them to the types of things that we really probably take for granted in the West.
Now, one of the things that sounds like is happening in Tunisia is you have a commonality between the secularist and the Islamist. And that doesn't seem to be the case in the rest of the countries. I mean, there's sort of a big divide between those two forces. It sounds like the groups in Tunisia are a little more malleable and more workable with the other side. Is that your understanding?
Well, of course, what has happened is both the democratic activists and the more religious Islamic activists, they both were jointly persecuted by the Ben Ali government. So at the moment, I think there's a sense of unity that probably over time that will start to unwind a little bit as they start to go to their separate corners and they start to realize that actually they are much more in competition against one another. Hopefully that will be through a democratic process, an ongoing democratic process. But at the moment, I think they still to this day, there is concern in Tunisia that the vestiges of the last government, President Ben Ali's people, some of whom are still in the country, are going to find a way to insinuate themselves back into politics. So that's something that, you know, people are very nervous about. Every candidate right now faces real scrutiny as to what is your background, because people want to know, did you have any connection with the old way, because that's not what they want.
That's the kiss of death.
It's the kiss of death, yeah.
Let's talk about one of the big issues for Tunisia. And there's a recent World Bank report which looked at the restrictions on economic participation, which the Ben Ali government, you know, it held a large part of the economy very closely within cronies. And now the state has taken that property back, but it really hasn't, I suppose it doesn't even know how to go about divesting itself of that and in a way in which it doesn't end up in more cronies' hands.
Well, there is an issue now of economic disparities between urban areas, between the coast and the interior. You know, it was in the interior that the Arab Spring began when a young man really had no option except to sell fruit in the street. And even that very basic subsistence lifestyle was affected by a policewoman stealing from him. And basically, mm-hmm. he had no recourse. And so he took his life, setting himself on fire. And this is what launched the protest in Tunisia that spread quickly to the rest of the Arab world. So it really was founded on a revolution, not really on ideology, not on religion, but on dignity and upon economic opportunity. One of the first public opinion polls done in Tunisia after Ben Ali left was done by my organization, and we found at that time 79% felt things would be better in a year. Well, as I said, democracy takes a long time to mature, and now we're 3 years into Tunisia's Arab Spring, and I've got to say our most recent poll done in June of this year shows a lot of alienation because people's economic situations aren't getting better. They won't get better for a little while longer. Things still need to stabilize. But economic disparities between, again, the interior, the coast, the cities, the rural areas, that's going to be a major challenge. Whoever wins this election and forms a new government is going to actually probably ask themselves one day, why did I do this? Because they've got a big task ahead of them.
Well, let's contrast what's going on in Tunisia to the rest of the countries of the Arab Spring. We've seen the problems in Libya, in Egypt. Certainly, Syria is just a horrific story, but there are equally bad stories in Egypt and Libya. Is there any signs that we're seeing a democratization there, or is it just another autocratic government in most of those places, or lack of government?
I think one thing we've seen in the Arab Spring, and it's something, a lesson for people in this field to keep in mind, is removal of a dictator does not necessarily mean something better follows. And you're dealing with traumatized societies, you're dealing with corrupt systems and inefficient systems. And so in a place like Egypt, when it had its election last year, the people who took office, regardless of the fact that they were the Muslim Brotherhood, They took office with a very aging, corrupt, inefficient bureaucracy that was as incapable of delivering service to the Egyptian people as it was under the previous regime. The only difference was the new government cared. The old Mubarak government didn't care. So you have these challenges. Again, generational change. Americans are not very patient people. That's not one of our virtues. But we have to think back to how long it took our founding fathers and our early governments to actually become service-oriented, to actually become capable of governing. And we're just going to have to give time. And it's frightening to do because, as you say, we see the challenges with ISIS. We see now the problems in Libya. But we have to stay the course.
You mentioned Libya. What's happening in Libya today? Because I think given Benghazi and everything else that's happened, we've just kind of turned the American attention away from Libya in the wake of everything that happened.
Libya is another place that I went to shortly after the ouster of Muammar Gaddafi. Mm-hmm. And as you got off the airplane at the connecting bridge, it was filled with bullet holes. And when you walked into the terminal, the chairs were all flipped over as if suddenly people had just jumped up and run. And this was, you know, a few months after Muammar Gaddafi was gone. What you noticed right away was there were armed people everywhere. And the problem was there was no police. There really was no army. There were militias everywhere, and they controlled these five blocks of downtown, this road to the airport, and they were all competing with one another. There was not an early enough move to try to either integrate them into a police force or into an army. Certainly there was not any attempt to try to limit the number of arms they had. And when I'm talking about limiting the number of arms, I'm not talking about handguns and rifles, but we're talking about, I saw a truck driving alongside us that had a mortar put into the back bed of the truck. Another one had an anti-aircraft gun in the back of a Toyota pickup truck. Eventually, those people, again, what else do they have to do except use those guns, use those weapons to shake down businesses, to settle historic grievances? And that's what we have seen. Libya really never had. It was really a tabula rasa. It was a blank slate. Gaddafi made certain there was no such thing as civil society. More than four people could not meet at a time. This was a place that really had nothing. Tunisia has some vestiges of democratic governance. Egypt had elections and had a parliament. Libya had nothing. It had the one man. And so they're really starting from scratch there. And it's going to take a long time in Libya for the militias to be disarmed, these young people to actually have jobs. But also you do have a bit of a conflict there between Islamists and secularists that is being played out pretty violently. We've evacuated the U.S. embassy. Almost any Westerner is no longer there. We are seeing what could have been Tunisia. Tunisia is just next door. And actually, Tunisia worries about the spillover effect into their country.
Yeah. It sounds as if Libya is somewhat feudal in a way. I mean, a bunch of militias, warlords, you know, a leader of each of these militias, and they're basically, this is my turf. I'm going to try to get a little bit of your turf. And until they sort through that, and it sounds like the rest of the Western world is leaving them to figure it out.
I think that's true. And, of course, when I would see these young bands of militia, primarily young people, young men, I can recall one man lifting up his shirt and showing me bullet wounds where he was shot during the fight against Gaddafi's people, and his best friend, he said, died next to him. And now this young man has weapons. He has a militia under him. There are people like that everywhere. But then, of course, as in any society, there are families, there are men and women, there are business owners. There are people who don't want this but are really powerless to try to stop it. And I think probably the next so-called Libyan revolution is going to have to be average men and women trying to take their country back street by street, city by city, by refusing to engage in this kind of violence.
My guest today is Tom Garrett, the Vice President of the International Republican Institute. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, talking about Tunisia and the aftermath of the Arab Spring. But I want to talk about another area which you've been going back to, which is actually where you started your career with the IRI, which was in Ukraine. And this was in the late 80s, I think, and you were helping organize some of the first elections in the newly independent Ukraine. Now you're back there. Give us a sense of what is at the heart of this. I mean, as far as I can see, it's two ethnicities, predominantly Russian ethnicity in the east, the Ukrainian in the west, and an inability to relate to one another. I mean, their elections have been, from what I can see, a Ukrainian party versus a Russian-backed party through most of its history. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think for all of your listeners who are international relations fans, October 26 is going to be very interesting. That's the Tunisian elections we've been speaking about, but it's also the Ukrainian parliamentary elections on the very same day. These will both be taking place on Sunday, October 26. And the stakes are high for both. The stakes are high for the countries, each country, but also for the regions. And so in Ukraine, I think a bit of the Russian-Ukrainian divide has been somewhat overplayed. When I was living there during the time you mentioned, it was a little bit more pronounced. But over time, again, generational change occurred. And younger Ukrainian people interchangeably speak Russian or Ukrainian. And actually, as their country didn't collapse, it didn't progress a lot, but as it didn't collapse, people slowly began in Ukraine to say, we could really make a go of this. We are a nation. We can make this happen. What you saw happening in Ukraine this year was very much tied, once again, to economics. Young people in Ukraine that had no nostalgia for the Soviet Union the way their grandparents did. Young people in Ukraine were told by the president, Viktor Yanukovych, he would lead Ukraine into the European Union with all of the prosperity and the freedoms that's associated with. When suddenly last November he announced, we're not doing it, days before the treaty was to be signed. And he said, we're going to enter into a customs union with Russia and Kazakhstan, hardly models of desirable free enterprise and opportunity for people. And that's what took young people to the streets, is the fact that, you know, they heard an iron curtain, so to speak, being closed on their aspirations for travel, education, opportunity to work and prosper. And so what you really have going on is it's really between the forces of the old with that nostalgia for the Soviet Union and when Russia and the Soviet Union were world superpowers and the young that want to see something new and fresh.
Mm. Do the older generations, they see how Putin has, you know, clamped down on the freedoms they see, but he's also sort of re-energized Russia to an extent. Is that sort of like the strong leader? Oh, this is somebody we can go with. What's at the heart of that attraction to not the Soviet Union, but Russia?
I think, you know, if this had taken place, what's going on since January of this year in Ukraine, if this had happened in 1995, 1996, I think there would have been much more widespread support for entry into a relationship, especially with Russia. But again, that's changed over the decade or so, the last two decades. One of the things I feel that is going on is Vladimir Putin does not want a neighboring Ukraine that is a part of Europe and probably therefore prospering and probably therefore democratic. He doesn't want that on the border of his Russia with his Russian people, because that's not the path he's laid out for them. He's laid out a very autocratic, authoritarian future. And for so very long, Russians referred to Ukrainians as our little brothers. And there was this idea of the Slavic unity. Putin has done more to destroy that illusion. He's done more to create Ukrainian nationalism through what he's done this year than any other outsider could have done.
I mean, we're already seeing evidence that this is spinning out of control, because you do have Russian ethnicities and Ukrainian ethnicities within the Ukraine, mm-hmm. you know, fighting at this point. Could this sort of lead to a real serious sort of nationalistic antagonism like we saw in the Balkans or something like that?
I don't see where it goes a lot further from where it is now. And now it's pretty bad.
Yeah.
But Crimea did have a predominantly Russian population. Why is that? Because in the Soviet Union, it was the policy to relocate people there, Russian people from the heartland there. Donetsk and Luhansk cities are actually Russian majority cities, but the provinces that surround them are Ukrainian majorities.
Is that the same policy where Russians were moving into Donetsk and those?
Yes.
Yeah. Basically, Ukrainian lands, but you've had this huge immigration from
for decades Russia. From the Soviet Union settlement policies. However, once you start moving into the center part of Ukraine and the western part, you start running out of those pockets of Russian settlement. And so I don't see it going a lot further unless Putin decides he wants to just go into an all-out war with Ukraine. He doesn't really have a base in the rest of Ukraine from which to foment trouble. So I am hoping we're going to see this tension ratcheted down. Today, President Poroshenko spoke before a joint session of our U.S. Congress, and he made clear that he considered Crimea part of Ukraine, Donetsk and Lugansk part of Ukraine. He has to do that. But I do think that probably the situation is going to sort of stabilize a bit now, again, unless Putin just decides he wants to go all out.
What about the fate of Crimea? Do you think it's now Russian at this point, or will that be negotiated? Or
it's interesting because the presence of Crimea as a part of Ukraine would actually have been a problem one day for Ukraine if it ever were to join NATO, because NATO won't take in a member that has a foreign base on its soil. And even under the Ukrainian governance of Crimea, there were always Russian bases there, and those were not really a matter of contention. The Russians were keeping those, and that was sort of like Guantanamo Bay on the island of Cuba. Mm-hmm. Crimea itself has no water, and it has no electricity-generating capacity. It's going to be of extreme expense to Russia to try to get water onto Crimea, get electricity to the people of Crimea without Ukraine's help. If Ukraine shuts off those two things, it's a semi-arid peninsula, and it's going to have a hard time surviving. Ukraine can survive without Crimea. Again, I understand President Poroshenko can't surrender it, but Ukraine will survive without it. The loss of the lands in the east, that's going to be a little bit harder, and that's something I think Ukraine is going to have to work very aggressively to try to turn around.
And, of course, the other part of it is, yes, Crimea has to have water and electricity, but Ukraine needs gas. And they, that has traditionally come from Russia.
They do. And it's been one interesting thing. On one of my last trips to Ukraine, I met with environmental groups. And one of the things Ukrainian Greens are worried about is the very active arrival of Western energy companies who are telling us there is shale oil there that Ukraine is sitting upon, a sizable reserve of frackable oil. Right. And so the Greens don't want that. And that's going to be an interesting political debate because the rest of Ukraine needs and wants energy independence from Russia to survive. So if that's true that these huge reserves are there, it could really change things. We've seen the price of oil dropping below $100 recently, and the impact on Russia is visible. Gas is their weapon against Europe, but it may not be there forever for them.
It'll be interesting to see what happens. Well, are you headed back to Tunisia soon, or is your immediate portfolio now more Ukraine today?
Well, because we do have elections October 26 in both countries. The International Republican Institute, along with our sister organization, the National Democratic Institute, we will both be putting international observation missions into both countries. At the moment, I'm headed to Ukraine, but then I'll probably head to Tunisia for that November election, which will be the presidential election after this October parliamentary election. So I'm eager to see both. Our institute has friends of many, many years in both countries. And I have to tell you, it's one of the things that makes this job worthwhile is actually working with these men and women that are trying to bring democracy to their countries. I grew up studying George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson. But, you know, I studied them. In these countries, I'm actually getting to see them in action.
All right. Well, Tom Garrett, thanks very much for your
time.
Thank
you.
Tom Garrett is the Vice President for Global Programs at the International Republican Institute, a nonpartisan NGO devoted to the cause of democracy promotion. He's worked extensively with the governments in Tunisia as well as the Ukraine. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.